Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. It is not Andre Hakes. It is Jeff Leonard. Jeff Leonard sitting in for Andre Hakes. Who's doing one of two things. She's out conquering the legal world or welcoming Mike Pence to Washington, D.C. My guess is she's the first, if it is the first. So anyway, good morning. This is Straight Talk. And today I'm honored to be joined by Eric Born. It's E-R-I-A-R-I-K, B-J-O-R-N. Eric, are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning, Eric.
Today, Jeff.
Hey, before we start, I just want to do a little brief intro on Eric. Eric is my friend. Eric is a very good friend of mine. In fact, Eric did the reading at my wedding before he took off to go to South Carolina to appear to become a political... Can we call you a disruptor, Eric, or what do we call you down there?
I'm just a dude.
So you are a dude, but you jumped in to the political sphere with both feet. And you took on Joe Wilson in your first maiden voyage. Joe Wilson, Joe Uli Wilson, is the congressman from South Carolina that yelled at Barack Obama, "You lied," during the State of the Union address. And instead of just being angry, you decided to take him on and run for his seat.
Yeah, no, that was the last year of my life has been certainly interesting. Number one, it's really good to be in there with you guys. 97. Thank you very much. Straight Talk. Where do we start? This kind of serves as a debrief for me.
We're having a little. You're breaking up a little bit. Can you get to a better spot to talk, or are you? Can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you need to get to a better spot. Your cell's dropping out of me a little bit.
Hold on. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Now it's a commercial. It's a lot better. So you moved from Charlottesville and then moved down to South Carolina where now and you ran a program for the University of South Carolina. You're a single dad. What on earth prompted you, and you're a prolific writer, what on earth prompted you to put yourself out there in the public sphere to run for public office?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I guess background is good here. So, in fact, it was kind of funny. I was out at a tavern last night and somebody was asking me that very question, so it was a good preface. My public political background began back during the Boston Marathon massacre. I was so distraught following that event that I wrote an essay and submitted it to a large Facebook group, Rachel Maddow Fan Club, and just saying, hey, I don't know if you publish these kinds of essays, but here you go. And the next thing I know, I got an email and said, hey, you're hired. I said, hired for what? And the guy said, I'm the editor for Ford Progressive's website, and you can write on any subject you want as long as it's about politics, and we'll put it up there. I was like, wow, what an honor. So that was about 4 years ago. I started writing for Ford Progressive, and then I started writing for Patheos, which is the world's largest religion website. And I guess a couple of years later, before you know it, I've written articles that have been read in 190 countries by over a million people, and I've authored 5 books. But as to politics, back 4 years ago, I walked into my election station and looked at the election ballot in front of me, and it was Joe Wilson versus nobody. Joe Uli Wilson. I mean, of all people, a district of 700,000 people, not one person stood up against him as a Democrat. And that stuck with me for the next 2 years. I walked into the voting booth 2 years later, and it was Joe Wilson versus a fake Democrat.
Yeah, you say, I was following your, and that's my next question, is I was following you closely, as we are friends, and I'm a big fan of yours. You had a pretty bitter primary, a Democratic primary, that you barely won, and you kept branding your opponent as a fake Democrat. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, we had possibly the most circus-like pandemonium primary in the history of the United States of America. So my primary opponent for South Carolina Congressional District 2 was an actual fake Democrat Unfortunately, he's a fake Democrat who won in 2014 against a real Democrat. He's so far right, he is to the right of Donald Trump. He advocated for a special Mexican tax, which, I mean, he didn't even have the decency to insult the Hispanic Latino community in the right way. He wanted all African Americans to be drug tested before going into the ER. And this man was on the 2014 Democratic Party ballot. And like I said, so I walked into the booth, and there it was. It was Joe Wilson versus a fake Democrat. Joe Wilson's Democratic Party opponent was actually further to the right than Joe Wilson.
It sounds like Joe Wilson handpicked. You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Our guest on the radio, on the phone, is Eric Bjorn, just coming off an election where he lost to Joe Wilson in the Congressional United States House of the Congress, 2nd District. So you won. It was, I mean, the victory didn't get announced for a couple of days after. You won by about, how many votes did you win the primary by?
Well, so the primary election, we won by 44 votes at the end of the day. And here's the trick. Now, so I wasn't sure I was going to run this year, but I was inspired by Bernie Sanders. He came and spoke at the Medallion Center just down the street from where I live last August. And after he spoke, I said, you know, I can really do this. I've managed a $2 billion science program for our state. I'm a community organizer. I've managed a big arts festival. People sort of know who I am, and I know I have the skill set to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it if nobody else does it. And the deadline was at the end of March, and I waited and I waited and I waited for some Democrat to show up on the ballot at the primary level, and nobody did. And I finally said, well, it's 2016. Donald Trump could be the nominee on the other end of the ballot. There can be no empty ballots this year. So, you know, I popped over the, you know, I don't know if people realize this. It costs more than $4,000 just to run.
Just to register and to get on the ballot? Or
just to run for Congress. Like Senate is $10,000. House is $4,000 plus to run for either of the two major parties. It's a set percentage of the salary of the position. I mean, it is no small potatoes to walk into
the
local state election commission and register to run for office.
But, and because I know you, I know a little bit about your background. You're a single dad. Your daughter is, what, 10 now?
In fact, I looked her in the face the other day and I said, in 2 weeks you're going to be half the age of an adult. She'll be 9.
Okay. And you also take care of your mom. And so,
I do.
So $4,000 to you, while it may not be a lot to Joe Wilson or to other people, that's a commitment to a single dad.
And, it was huge. You know, there's a contributor in Pennsylvania who helped quite a bit with that original filing fee, but I kicked in the rest. And you know, I'm just a public librarian. In fact, as far as anybody knows, I'm the only person who worked full time the entirety of his U.S. Or his or her U.S. congressional campaign. I kicked in, I don't know, I think I calculated that to be about 20% of my annual salary. And I don't make a lot. You're right, I'm a single dad with a 9-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old mom living with them. It hurts. In fact, I'm writing a book right now, so I ran for Congress, and I'm thinking of subtitling it, and all I got was this lousy bankruptcy.
You did something I've never seen before, and I'm sure our listeners probably have never seen it before either, is you ran as the nominee, as the chosen nominee for both the Democratic Party and the Green Party. And I was a little confused looking at the ballot because Eric Bjorn had a D next to his name, and then two names down, it was Eric Bjorn had a G next to his name. How did that happen? First of all, how did that happen?
You know, it's really interesting, and so let me explain how fusion candidacies work. Once upon a time, in all 50 states, essentially, you could run as a fusion candidate. A fusion candidate is somebody who runs for a particular office for more than one party at the same time. As it stands now in 2016, that can only happen in 8 states anymore. Only 8 states allow a fusion candidacy, but it used to be allowed in almost all of the states. So what happened is I won the Democratic Party primary by all 44 votes, but I did win, And then the Green Party approached me and said, we were so impressed with your primary campaign and with your political background and worldview, we would like to know, would you be willing to stand for our, you know, as our candidate as well? And I went, oh, I'm totally honored by that. So what that means is on the November 8th ballot, I actually appeared twice. It was Eric Bjorn, Democratic Party, A-R-I-K-B-J-O-R-N, for anybody looking for me on Facebook, and Eric Bjorn, Green Party. And people, I got a lot of messages throughout the campaign, especially getting close to election time, saying, we just got our absentee ballot, and your name is on there twice. Will we be splitting the vote? I'm like, no.
You there?
Their own vote. But there were, here's what's really wonderful. There were four. There are seven congressional districts, and well, there was one U.S. Senate seat open in South Carolina. Four of us were Democratic Party candidates and Green Party candidates, and also South Carolina AFL-CIO endorsed. One was the U.S. Senate candidate, Thomas Dixon, myself in District 2 against Joe Wilson, the man, Dimitri Cherney, who ran against Mark Sanford, Appalachian Trail Mark Sanford.
Well known.
Mal Hyman, who ran against Tom Rice. So there were four of us, and we met each other early on before the primary, and we started referring to ourselves as the South Carolina Blue Brothers because we were all fusion candidates, which really designated us to the public as progressives. I mean, nobody's going to be a Democratic Party and Green Party fusion candidate who doesn't, you know, who isn't a deep blue, die-in-the-wool progressive. In fact, we started a Facebook page called SC Blue Brothers, and to this day, I don't think the four of us have found a single policy issue that we disagree on.
Do you think that helped running as both a Green, or did the confusion outweigh the benefit that running on for both?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I was looking at the results last night, looking forward to our interview. It's funny. I personally received twice the percentage of votes that Jill Stein did in the whole state. I looked at that number and it shocked me. I mean, she got point. I mean, this is South Carolina, so the Green Party isn't particularly. It's not Washington State. It's not Oregon. It's not Massachusetts. She got 0.8 or 0.9% of the total state vote, but I got 1.7% of the Green vote. I got twice as much percentage-wise as Jill Stein did.
And they added.
That was why I accepted with honor their request that I become a Green candidate, because I knew that 2016 was a bridge year. There were a certain number of voters who would refuse to come across and vote for Hillary. I'm not making a qualitative judgment. That was just a fact. It was going to happen. And I knew that if I also had a Green candidacy on the ballot, there would be people who would come over and vote for me that wouldn't vote for Hillary. Did it work? It certainly worked. It was an amazing strategy that the South Carolina Green Party employed that no other state Green Party employed, because it wasn't just me, it was three other federal candidates. And I personally believe that in the eight states where fusion is a possibility, that's the best. It's the best strategy for coalition politics that you can accomplish in the United States.
So to take multiple parties' endorsement, that might be the way a third-party candidate eventually is able to unseat one of the two major parties, is to cobble together three or four minor party endorsements and collect.
Right.
I hadn't even thought about that.
Or another way to think about it is it might be the way that a third party can ever actually achieve federal office.
That's exactly
or state,
right.
Or statewide office.
Exactly. You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7. This is Jeff Leonard sitting in for Andre Hakes. Our guest is Eric Bjorn, B-J-O-R-N. Is Viking pejorative, or do you prefer Norseman? It's his website is born, B-J-O-R-N, to the number, run.com. So you are a proud Norseman, are you not?
No, honestly, I prefer kinsman of Thor.
Kinsman of Thor. So you, as I understand political parties, they're pretty insular. They're hard to penetrate, especially as an outsider. And you are somewhat of a disruptor, somewhat of a person that speaks their mind. You're highly intelligent. You're highly credentialed. You're highly educated. But you're a stranger to them. So it seems to me like when you walked into the Democrats, the Democratic Party, you probably had to fight that machine for acceptance. And then if you ever got that acceptance, you had to fight the GOP and their machine to run against them. Is that fair to say?
You know, it's the most important question to ask. And it's a question that really needs to be asked at a national level. I mean, at a national level, people need to know that my campaign existed, and not just mine, but the other three South Carolina Blue Brothers. And we need to talk about this because this is part of the major national problem. Yes, I was most assuredly a new token on the political board. I had never run so much as for anything, you know, not even like municipal dog catcher. Now, I ran a $2 billion program for the state of South Carolina. I knew many of the political officials, the elected officials, from a, you know, government perspective, but I knew very few of them from a political perspective, and they didn't know me from a political perspective. But the problem is, Jeff, that I walked onto the scene at the end of March, and there hadn't been a candidate. There hadn't been a Democratic Party candidate in South Carolina Congressional 2 for 4 years. That's wholly unacceptable. I mean, you know, I pat myself on the back and because I stood up to run in an impossible situation. But the Democratic Party did a ridiculously horrible job of recruiting and supporting prior candidates for the last 4 years. How can we have a U.S. congressional seat where there was nobody, not one person to stand? How could that be possible? But I did it anyways.
It's bad for democracy. It's terrible for democracy. You don't have two opposed. You don't even have a discussion. You're just abdicating this liar.
I don't have the number in front of me, and I don't know how, you know, normal this is across American and Southeastern politics. But I'm going to venture to guess that 30%, one-third of the elected offices in South Carolina are unopposed seats. Whether that's Democrats running unopposed right. or Republicans running unopposed.
That's thanks to gerrymandering. I mean, they just designed the line so no one else can even contest. I mean, people in power like to stay
right.
in power.
I mean, in my own local state Senate seat, unopposed. So many seats run unopposed, and it's ridiculous because nobody should run off to Washington or run off to their capital without having to prove their merit to the people.
No one should take their service for granted. No one should say, this is my seat. It's not your seat, Joe Wilson. It belongs to the people.
So, right. And at the end of the day, that's why I ran. I ran. I ran because nobody else would. I gave myself a seat. You know, I won't pretend like I didn't have it in the back of my mind and that I wasn't thinking about it for several years. But I was insulted by the fact that ballot went empty.
Or, as we all should be,
and that there was a fake Democrat attached to the ballot. By the way, everybody should know, you know, one hour after I registered to vote, at the end of the deadline, the fake Democrat registered. So can't tell me there wasn't cahoots going on.
I remember when that happened. It seemed like it was a coordinated effort where if you or someone else had not have run, then that person would not have filed, thus ensuring Joe Wilson a walk.
No, it's far more, it's much more complex and much more important than that. In 2016, the Democratic Party needed, I mean, Columbia is the capital city, you know, 700,000 people in our district.
Major university, the biggest university in town, the biggest university in South Carolina.
Well, they needed to be able to tell people to vote straight ticket. If there had been a fake Democrat on the ballot, as there was in 2014, the party couldn't have made phone calls and told voters to vote straight ticket. They would have had to say, vote Democrat for everybody except for District 2. And that's a complex phone call to make, you know, in a two-minute phone call on a Tuesday night when people are done with the workday. It's much easier just to say, hey, you know, hey, Bob, nice to hear from you. Thanks for your $25 donation to the party. By the way, when you go into the booth, you know, on November 8th, vote straight ticket. If I hadn't have run, if Phil Black, the fake Democrat, had been on the ticket, the party wouldn't have been able to say vote straight ticket. And that's why, getting back to your question, Yeah, I had to introduce myself quickly to the Democratic Party here in the state and gain their assurance that I was a legitimate candidate, which I hoped would be obvious since, you know, I ran a $2 billion program. I've been writing for 5 years. You know, if you Googled my name before March 23rd, there was plenty out there to assure anybody that I was, you know, definitely left of center. But the problem was, Jeff, I was too left of center. I was too far left of center for anybody's comfort.
In the Democratic
Party.
Right.
I supported Bernie Sanders early on. In fact, I was a volunteer who put on an event that 1,000 people attended here in South Carolina, which was a big deal.
I remember.
One of the most attended events in South Carolina for the presidential primary, and I put it on as a volunteer, and I spent $0.
And you were, Eric, you were front and center. I've got your pictures up on the 94.7. We have to take a break in a second, but you were front and center when they took that Confederate battle flag down from the South Carolina State Capitol. You were there. You were a guardsman.
Yeah.
You were willing to give of yourself to make sure the right thing was done. And you deserve
all... Yeah, you're right. You're right. In fact, as a point of history, I was the last person to ever give a speech about the Confederate flag in South Carolina. We had several, I'm sure people remember, you know, even outside of South Carolina, there were several big rallies, you know, we call it Take It Down, following the massacre at Mother Emanuel in Charleston. By the way, the only reason Nikki Haley said we should take that flag down is because she realized that if she didn't say that, there were going to be a million people in that state house.
Yeah.
Protesting within a few weeks. Don't for one minute people think that she actually cared. What she cared about was the fact that a million people were about to show up.
She was about to have
protesting.
A thing out of control. All right, let's take a break. Eric, hang tight. We'll be back in about 60 seconds. All right, thanks for being here. You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7. Now back to Straight Talk. Jeff Leonard here. Eric, you still with us?
Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
Hey, did you just hear that underwriting for Guys and Dolls we're doing here in Charlottesville? We're a sponsor.
Hey.
You're a thespian.
Hey, don't.
You've been on stage.
Dolls, man. Don't rock the boat. Show up for Guys and Dolls.
So watch, you know, as we are friends, I was watching your campaign pretty closely. One of your lines I found to be hilarious and it probably has more meaning than at initial glance. It says, I'm not the kind of Democrat to sit around in a seersucker suit and sip sweet tea. What does that mean?
While civilization crumbles all around me. let's be honest. There's a certain type of Democrat that thinks politics is a backyard game of croquet. And the man in the seersucker suit is a real person.
Really?
I encountered him during the campaign. I'm not going to name him right now.
Please don't.
But I will later. I will later.
Okay.
He's real. He's the reason why we are where we are, not just as South Carolina, but as a nation. There's a certain kind of country club Democrat that plays Democrat after work, but wouldn't dare be seen talking about domestic violence, talking about rape, talking about real in-the-street, back-alley, dark shadow issues that matter, where so many of our citizens are trapped because they live high on the hog, politics is their life, they're academics, life is good, they wear seersucker suits and sip sweet tea. Meanwhile, the rest of us are, you know, burning or, you know, drowning, whatever metaphor you want to use. So, yeah, the man, I use that almost every speech, almost everywhere I went. I said I'm not going to sit around in the seersucker suit and sip sweet tea because I watched those people do just that. And they were members of the DNC Executive Committee in our state, in my district, who refused to support me, who put on fundraisers for centrist candidates several blocks from where I live, but would not endorse, would not talk about, would not help, would not support our campaign against Joe Wilson. So at the end of the day, if you're not standing up for me and you live in my district, you're supporting Joe Wilson and you're supporting Donald Trump. Maybe you don't like the fact that I'm too far left of center of you, but if you didn't stand up for this campaign, you stood up for Donald Trump, and damn you to hell. And I hope that quote gets out there. It's for history. There were Democrats. I'm not just talking about the average voter. I'm talking about Democratic Party establishment leadership, which intentionally blocked me, which intentionally did not speak up for me, which intentionally did not raise a dollar for our campaign because they felt we were too left of center. What the hell is too left of center to say that I stand against domestic violence, that I stand for a living wage, that I stand for health care as a human right? Yet there were Democratic Party leaders, not just in my state, not just in my district, not just in my county, but in my neighborhood, that refused to endorse our campaign that was absolutely down-the-line Democratic Party policy platform. But I'm not country club.
You're not.
I got early, I got invited to speak at a two-day anti-rape culture rock music festival here in Columbia. I mean, the average person probably had 7 or 8 tattoos and piercings. It was hardcore. But guess what? It was the one event in the whole campaign where I met where almost everybody was already registered to vote.
And the Democrats
I'm on a roll, man. These damned establishment Democrats who can't even be seen in a room with somebody with a tattoo or a nose piercing wouldn't stand up for our campaign. But I was the only politician to walk into, it was an event called Coachella. I gave 2 speeches over 2 nights about anti-rape culture. Nobody, not one other politician, not one other elected official stood foot in that room. I am the only politician in the history of South Carolina to even attend SC Black Pride. I am the first politician in South Carolina to hold a transgender meet and greet. But the establishment Democratic Party elected officials and leadership won't attend these events, won't stand up for these communities, and won't support candidates who do. And it's a damned crying shame.
It's not. That doesn't happen in a vacuum, Eric. I think part of when the autopsy is done as to why President-elect Trump won is that it's hubris throughout the elite of the Democratic Party. They would rather spend their whole time talking about the African American voter, talking about the uneducated white voter, than actually talking with either one of those constituencies. And it's plain and simple hubris. The liberal redneck who I adore, he's coming to Charlottesville, by the way. We're gonna have ticket giveaway on Straight Talk, hopefully. He has a thing. He says, "Well, because of course poor people are gross." No self-respecting Ivy League liberal would deign to go down and talk to someone with a nose.
Oh my God, Jeff! They smell. Oh my goodness, they don't. They don't look like a J. Crew catalog. Come on,
they don't play squash, Eric. What do you want me to do?
Why would I want to go hang out with people who aren't just like me? You don't have sweet tea and seersucker suit. Oh my goodness, they're the real people. Why do I want to associate with them?
So. On that note,
oh my God, it makes me sick to my stomach, and that's why I am so in support of Keith Ellison. I hope you have a couple of DNC executive committee members listening in tonight or today, or anybody who knows anybody in Virginia on the DNC.
I've got that question coming up, but you're on a roll. I want to keep you there. Hold on a second. So I watched. You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard, sitting in for Andre Hakes. We've got Eric Bjorn, A-R-I-K-B-J-O-R-N, borntorun.com, as our guest. Eric, I watched several times your debate with Representative Wilson, and frankly, you destroyed him in the debate. You caught him in a lie about violence against women. You held him to the mat and tapped him out. He lied in the debate. You called him out in real time, and you got no traction. Nobody cared that he lied, and you pinned him with it. What's going on?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Number one, I didn't call him Joe Eli Wilson throughout the entire campaign because I thought it was I didn't think it was campaign worthy. Everybody in the world called him Joe Uli Wilson, and frankly, I think he got off on it at night because I think he's a racist. And I think he enjoyed the fact that people, you know, knew him as the man who stood up to President Obama, even though his call out was a complete lie in and of itself. So I called him Status Quo Joe throughout the entire campaign. Until that moment in the debate when he lied. He lied on PBS, on South Carolina PBS, in our debate about his vote on the Violence Against Women Act. He lied about his vote. He said he voted for the act, and he didn't. And you're right. Nobody cared. But I called him out, and I put on a social media campaign. But who did actually? You know, the thing is, people did care. You know who cared? Women cared. I got so many private messages from women saying, thank you for making domestic violence a core issue in your campaign. And damn Joe Wilson for voting against the Violence Against Women.
South Carolina
and
is
yes, he lied about it. And that's when I started calling him. That's when I started calling him Joe, not Uli Wilson, but Joe Eli Wilson.
South Carolina is the fifth most dangerous place in this country for a woman to live, based on domestic violence and sexual assault.
And it used to be number one. It used to be the worst. South Carolina used to be the most dangerous state in the United States for a woman to live. Now I think it's third. Is it fifth?
Third
or fifth. Does it matter? You know what?
It doesn't really matter.
Nobody in South Carolina should be proud that it's third or fifth instead of first. No state in the United States should be proud until you're number 50.
And no one should, in that situation, should stand to have an elected official that votes against the Violence Against Women Act and then lies and says he did.
That's why there were a couple of conservative Republican women leaders who endorsed my campaign at that point and said, you know what, Joe, you not only lied about your vote on the Violence Against Women Act, you showed up at a domestic violence walk the next 2 days later and lied again. And told a large group of survivors, of victims, that you supported them. Oh, my God, but you're right. You're right, Jeff. Nobody cared. I mean, major media didn't care. Nobody gave it a printed word.
We care, Eric. You got to come on.
We could have a congressman lying on public television about his vote on the Violence Against Women Act, and not one major media response.
You know why? I think because I think it's a war on intellectualism. I think it's how global warming, there's even a debate about it, a false debate. It's because we're in an environment where my opinion is just as valid as your facts. Facts don't matter. And it's frustrating. Yeah, how do you win in an environment like that? How do you fight back to people who value their opinion more than demonstrable facts? Not even science. It's on the record, I voted against the Violence Against Women Act, and I lied about it in front of domestic violence and rape survivors. How does this happen?
Well, this is very important. This is probably the most important 2 minutes in this conversation, and that's one I wish we could bottle up and put in the Library of Congress for the future. You know, we went from the age of information to the age of misinformation almost overnight. I'm a librarian. I'm a librarian by profession. I have the academic degree of library science. If I know anything in this world, I know something about information that is legitimate and information that is not legitimate. It's my profession. It's something that I've dedicated years of my life to as a profession, as a librarian. We went from an age of information to an age of misinformation. How did we do that? You know, it's complex, but it's important to note that once upon a time, every single major newspaper in the United States had a library and had a staff of fact checkers. As a journalist, your job was to write the story and submit it to the library and to the team of fact checkers to make sure that everything in that story was authentic. Well, I clearly remember the day that the Wall Street Journal got rid of its library and its fact checkers. That was the death of journalism, and it was the moment that we entered into this age of misinformation, because no longer reporters themselves were now on the hook for validating their own stories. And guess what? That's not easy. it is not easy to write a complex story in journalism and make sure that you yourself have gotten every dang fact right. But the support group at major media for that was gone. So what did reporters start to do? They didn't have the fact checkers. They didn't have the library staff behind them anymore at Wall Street Journal, and then you know all the other newspapers that dropped their fact checking. Guess what? Reporters had to choose easier stories because they had to know because their jobs were on the line. If they put something forward that wasn't authentic,
or they relied on quotes. Relied on quotes from people that clearly had an interest in the outcome
right.
of the story.
All of a sudden, you had to rely on things that you could definitely fall back on and go, well, hey, they said it. I don't care if it's true or not. At least it's true that they said it. So we went from an age of information to an age of misinformation almost overnight. And that gave rise and birth to the clickbait, you know, movement and the fake news movement. And so all of a sudden, politicians realized, listen, I can say anything, and there's very little chance of anybody opposing me. And so Joe Wilson can lie.
With impunity.
Absolutely lie about his vote on a critical act, and nobody can care. Because, I probably half of the journalists out there couldn't verify his vote. And that was one of the strengths of our campaign, you know, as a librarian. Every single thing we put out on social media, every press release, every communication, period, I wrote myself, and I researched myself. I had a small staff, and they are really faithful and wonderful, and they helped out. But I double-checked. I mean, I put my my librarian hat on, and I put my librarian skill set, you know, to work during this campaign. I mean, I've been trained on how to research issues. I mean, my goodness, I can't tell you how many times you're a congressional candidate and somebody comes up to you and says, hey, how do you feel about the Amateur Radio Parody Act? I'm like,
I'll get back to you.
Yeah, well, but that happens all the time because everybody's got their pet issue.
That's correct.
So I would often look somebody in the face and say, you know what, I don't know anything about that. Sit down with me. Let's spend a few minutes talking about why this matters to you, and I'll go home and I'll do my research, and I will get back to you, you know, with my position on the issue. And people are like, really? I'm like, yeah. Like, how are you going to find it? I'm like, I'm a librarian.
I'm a librarian. I own books.
I can. I got this.
So before we go to break, I want to make sure one thing is clear. You beat Representative Joe Wilson so badly in that debate that at the next debate, he was a no-call, no-show. He wouldn't even show up again. You beat him so badly.
Yeah, we had two debates. One was three. We had a SCETV, which is the state PBS channel. We had a debate on that on Palmetto, seeing that Charles Gerbauer, the former CNN Asia Bureau chief, hosted. I creamed Joe Wilson on it, and that's the one where he lied about his vote. Then we had a debate in a local high school, which was a really neat
great
environment
idea.
Because at least half of the audience was high school students. In fact, there were even elementary students in the audience, and I creamed him in that debate too. I mean, there's no doubt I wiped Joe Wilson in both debates. And then there was a third forum that the NAACP chapter in the state hosted, and Joe didn't even show up.
But he committed to attend. You called me and said Joe Wilson has agreed to attend and debate me in this forum, and he didn't even show. So that tells you what
actually,
he thinks.
Actually, one of the major successes in our whole campaign, I got ridiculed by people from day one. They said, oh, whatever, I was like, why are you ridiculing me? Thank God. Shouldn't you be thanking God that I actually showed up and there's a name on the ballot? They're like, oh, you'll never get him to debate you. Well, guess what? I didn't just get one debate. I got two debates. And it's called it's called being creative. We went to the Peelian Peanut Party Parade.
I saw that picture. I saw the picture of you and your daughter shaking his hand. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean this is a part of the district where if I had a dollar for every Confederate flag I saw that day, we would have had enough to trounce Joe. I mean, they were shocked. I guarantee you, they were shocked that a Democrat even showed up for this parade. My daughter ran up to Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, and said, there's a better way. I hope you vote for my dad, Senator Graham.
Especially a liberal Democrat that shows up that could wrestle each of them to the ground in the submission.
Exactly, but Joe was standing there next to a camel. I'll never forget this. I still don't know why there was a camel in the parade, but Joe next to a camel just made me crack up. Joe Camel. So there he was standing there, and one of my campaign staff people walked up to him and said, "Congressman Wilson, you're gonna." And she had a big, you know, Bjorn T-shirt on. She said, "You're going to debate Eric Bjorn, right?" And he was kind of like a deer in the headlights. He's like, okay. And she ran back and said, "He said yes." I was like, "Come on, everybody." So as a staff, we ran over to Joe, and my staff photographer came with, and my daughter was there. I said, "Congressman Wilson, I want you to meet one of your constituents, my daughter, Kat." And, of course, he's got a kid in front of him. He's like, "Oh, hello, how are you?" And she's like, "Congressman Wilson, I just sat in your seat at the U.S. Capitol. I was warming it up for my dad." And the look on his face, and I said, "Hey, Congressman, you're going to debate me, right?" He's like, okay, we shook hands. God, and my photographer got a picture of us shaking hands, and it was in the big newspaper here, the state, newspaper, before the end of the day. And it said, "Wilson agrees to debate with Bjorn."
That's iconic.
That's how you win. You win by being creative.
All right, Eric, hold on. I got to take one more break, and then we'll come right back. All right, hang tight. Question for you. I think you've been waiting for this one. Representative Claiborne, an iconic African-American representative from South Carolina, is pushing someone I've never heard of named Jamie Harrison. He is the South Carolina Democratic chair as an alternative to Representative Keith Ellison for the chair of the Democratic National Committee. What do you know about this?
Well, I mean, And I hope you have some DNC Executive Committee members listening, or maybe there's somebody out there that knows somebody. I mean, this is important. The United States of America, Democratic politics left of center, could not have failed worse than they did. This was the worst election in history. It truly was. Following such a failure, what you hope is that leadership would fall on its sword and go, "We didn't do the job, and it's time for us to step aside. And for the people, it's time for a different approach." But that's not happening. Keith Ellison, Minneapolis 5th District, is a progressive. He's the only, he might be one of only two Muslim congresspeople in the U.S. He's a progressive voice. He's an amazing community activist. He's an amazing leader. I endorse him for DNC chair. It's time for that voice to come forward. If ever we needed, the fact that there's a Muslim in a city like Minneapolis serving, his constituents so well with such an active, progressive voice, he has the full support of his people. It's time for somebody like that to come forward in the age of Trump. Listen, there's going to be a Muslim registry in it anyway. And by the way, I'm going to be on it.
Yeah, you and I you and I were the first, yeah, I think, in the country to announce. I announced it on my radio station. I announced it on our Facebook. You announced it on Facebook that if, for some reason, this guy gets through a Muslim registry, you and I will be the first people to stand in line to register as Muslims.
You and I are going to be the first person in line, and we might be the first person in a camp. But I don't care, because you can't do this. You can't do this on my watch. I will stand up. I will be counted among those. At any rate, back to the question, Keith Ellison is running for DNC chair. I think Howard Dean just dropped out of the race. So it essentially makes it between Keith Ellison and Jamie Harrison. Jamie Harrison is a South Carolina Democratic Party chair. Jamie Harrison was Congressman Clyburn's close aide for a long time in Washington. He's the state chair here. It's important to note he's a lobbyist. He's a corporate lobbyist who has represented Walmart and Lockheed Martin. And he doesn't want anybody to know that. Well, it's too bad. It's a fact. He was a lobbyist for Walmart, and he's running for DNC chair. And haven't we had enough of that? I don't even shop at Walmart. Unless I have absolutely no recourse, you won't see me set foot in a Walmart.
And to build on your point, is they rely on corporate welfare. They pay their employees not even a living wage, so most of their employees have to go down to social services.
But let's go back to that. Yeah, did I use the bad word? Hopefully I got, zeroed out. But let's talk about that for a second. What's worse, the fact that I used a word that was a synonym for, you know, feces, or the fact that they're treating millions of Americans horribly? Where are our priorities as a country where a word takes precedence over human lives? That's the point, and that's the problem. So you've got a state Democratic Party chair who lobbied for Walmart versus an authentic progressive who will have none of that. I mean, how could there be a choice in the age of Trump? Are we really going to hold the center? You know, I don't want to say bad things about Jamie Harrison. I really don't. It's much easier for me to just say good things about Keith Ellison. He's the authentic progressive voice that the Democratic Party needs. For the most point, they blew off Bernie Sanders and his progressive message.
And the millions of voters that came with that message. And the millennials.
Had they held to the populism of Bernie, there's no doubt we would have won. But, you know, we can't go backwards. We can only go forward. So going forward, let's embrace an authentic progressive leader, an authentic progressive message. Let's get back to the core of the Democratic Party, which are unions, which are standing up for an acceptable workplace, acceptable wage, acceptable lifestyle, acceptable working and living conditions for Americans, you know, that doesn't bow and cater to billionaires. And that's what Keith Ellison brings to the table. And anything less than that is corporate centrism, which is why we're in the state and situation we are currently, not just in South Carolina, but the country.
You know, Keith Ellison has a bit of a tie to Charlottesville, or at least to our district. It was Virgil Goode, who was our representative at the time, who stood up on the House of Representatives and talked about Muhammad, and he was appalled that Keith Ellison was elected into the United States Congress as a Muslim and that he took the oath of office on a Quran. And then Keith Ellison had the best comeback. This is the first time I ever heard of it, the gentleman, and he immediately garnered my respect. He said two things. He said, one, Virgil doesn't know me from a can of paint. And the second thing that he said is, yes, I took the oath of office on a Quran that belonged to Thomas Jefferson. Shut up, essentially. But he didn't say it like that. He said,
let's not forget, you know, that reminds me, we were at the Gilbert Peach Festival, which is another festival where I fight a dollar for every Confederate flag. I encountered one woman who went on and on about Thomas Jefferson and the Founding Fathers. And I said, you know, you're right. Have you ever heard of the Jefferson Bible? And she said, what are you talking about? Of course Jefferson had a Bible. I said, no, have you ever heard of the Jefferson Bible? And I said, he created a version of the Bible. Well, of course he did, because he was a biblical scholar. I said, well, I mean, he was a man of the Enlightenment, but do you know what the Jefferson Bible is? He took, it's the four Gospels, he removed all of the miracles and just left in the teachings and said, this is what the Bible should be. And she looked at me with eyes that were, she wanted to kill me with her eyes. I said, you can go up to Charlottesville, up to Virginia, right now, and go, you can go put a copy of the original Jefferson Bible in your own hands. That's your founding father for you.
No one can challenge you on sort of biblical or religious text. You're credentialed. You've researched it. You've written, hundreds of thousands of words as a progressive religious man of faith, and these people who probably don't even own a Bible, or if they do, they don't read it, are trying to challenge you on what it says. You probably garner some enjoyment out of those interactions.
Well, I'll tell you what, I grew up in an evangelical home, and I attended Wheaton College, which, you know, famous as Billy Graham's alma mater, and I studied Greek for 10 years, and you know, I know how to speak evangelical because I once was one. And I don't say that in a disparaging way. I think a lot of evangelicals just haven't done enough of their own homework. But I can engage evangelicals in a way that Bernie Sanders cannot, in a way that Hillary Clinton cannot. I know how to speak to evangelicals in their own language because I once was one. I also know all of the hiccups in their argument. And when I'm engaging somebody, I look them straight in the fact, and I know the facts. I can talk to them on their own level, you know, the average Ted Cruz supporter. We can have a conversation unique in politics because I know what they're thinking and I know what the basis of their worldview is. I wrote for Pathos for a long time. I wrote for Forward Progressives on many religious subjects, and I've written some books, on theology. I wrote one article on the biblical definition of marriage that's been read by, I don't know, 2 million people at this point. It was written right around the time of the same-sex marriage debate. When it comes to these topics, the biblical text itself, it's always complex. You know, oh my God, is a politician talking about religion? Well, don't I have to?
In South Carolina, absolutely.
Since they are, don't I have to engage them at their own level? And I'm prepared to do so.
That's a yardstick that they use to measure you. A lot of people use religion as the yardstick with which to measure politicians for their political decision-making.
Right, right. Well, listen, going into this whole thing as a newbie to politics, or, of course, running for Congress, my impression was, and here's where I was incorrect. My impression was that religion was on the right, the Republicans were so steeped and soaked in religion. But at the end of the day, the Democratic Party is no less steeped in religion in wrong ways. And here's where I'm going to get into all sorts of trouble. But I don't care because it's a story that needs to be told at a national level. We need to start talking about this. I was at the South Carolina Democratic Party convention, and I walked up to one of the caucus tables, and somebody asked me about the Holy Spirit. It wasn't the faith religion. It wasn't the faith caucus, by the way. I was like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, don't you think that the Holy Spirit supports Hillary Clinton? I said, I can't even believe you're asking me the question. This is a South Carolina Democratic Party function. You're a leader of one of our caucuses in the party, and you're asking me an exclusively Christian question. I said, that's inappropriate. And the man sitting next to her said, yeah, and I'm an atheist. And I said, this is exactly why it's inappropriate. You've put this man in a very uncomfortable position. Religion does not belong in our politics. But time and again, I can't tell you how many official Democratic Party functions I went to where I heard more about the devil than Donald Trump. I was ashamed in each and every one of those moments to hear people, talking about religion at the center of this political event. Religion does not belong in Democratic Party politics. Christianity is not the official religion of the Democratic Party. And it's another reason why I support Keith Ellison for DNC chair, because there are too many Democrats running around thinking that the official religion is Jesus. It's not. I am myself personally a Roman Catholic and a proud Roman Catholic, but I keep my politics and my religion separated. And halfway through the campaign, I got sick and tired. Listen, as a politician, you are expected to show up for church on Sunday and go through the age-old routine of wearing your button and having people in the church walk up and see your button and go, okay, that's who I'm supposed to vote for. That's not right, and I stopped doing it. It's not the right thing to do. I began attending interfaith groups. I went to Unitarian churches. I went to interfaith festivals. I went to a Sikh temple. I went to Hindu temples. I wanted to introduce myself to the entire community of faith, not hoping to gain votes so much as saying, hey, I'm out here. I'm embracing you. We did the same thing, with the Hispanic Latino community. We had all of our literature translated into Spanish. As far as I know, I'm the only candidate in the history of South Carolina politics to have his literature translated into Spanish. We have almost, we have 100,000 Hispanic Latino voters in our state. But they're not embraced.
No, they're
whatsoever.
Not.
Whatsoever.
A shame.
No, I mean, but that's the thing. It's in the Southeast, what I learned was, oh, there's only two types of voters worth pursuing, whites and blacks. Are you kidding me?
Mm.
This is the Democratic Party. If you are a human being, your vote matters, to me, at least.
All right.
We embrace the Hispanic Latino community. We embrace communities of different faiths and different ethnicities. And, as you know, going forward as a politician, whether I am running for dog catcher or governor, I will always make sure that I try to find the full spectrum of humanity around me, embrace it, and go, hi, I'm Eric. I'm running for office. What you believe and how you think in your community matters to me.
All right, we got 3 minutes left. You're listening to Wake Up Call tomorrow with Rick Moore. Charlottesville State Delegate David Toscano will be in studio. It's brought to you by Markets of Tiger Fuel. 94.7 WPVC. This is Straight Talk. I'm Jeff Leonard, sitting in for Andre Hakes. We are with Eric Born, Bjorn, torun.com. Eric, I am scared to ask this question. What's next?
Oh, I guess you better get the red button.
We got 2 minutes and 30 seconds. What is next for you, my friend? Are you dropping out of politics, or are you just getting warmed up?
I'm just getting warmed up. I'm writing a book called So I Ran for Congress. It's going to be an authentic and honest reflection on what it was like the past 8 months. There were good things. There were bad things. There are horrible things in the national and state level of the Democratic Party. They need to be dealt with. If we don't deal with them, then Democratic Party politics continues to just be a backyard game of croquet where nothing will be accomplished and people who are suffering and dying will just continue to suffer and die. And we need to do something about that. We have governor races, we have Senate races, we have congressional races in 2018 all across the country. If we don't start getting serious about biting the throats of our opponents, we're going to keep losing. If we lose, people die. So am I running for office? Almost assuredly I'm going to run for office. What office? I'm not sure yet. Does the Democratic Party embrace me? I don't know. I guess we'd have to ask the Democratic Party. But I'll tell you what, people who are suffering embrace somebody who will walk up to them, touch them, hug them, say, I love you, I care for you, I'm going to do the best for you. Too many elected officials. We had Democratic Party elected officials in South Carolina endorsing Republicans 3 or 4 days before the election. That's beyond unacceptable. I'm ashamed to wear the hat of the Democratic Party when elected officials in my community endorse Republicans who stand with Trump. And guess what? Did our state leaders stand up to that? No, they just let it happen. They let it happen and not a word said otherwise. They crushed straight ticket voting in my neighborhood because this one elected official endorsed a Republican. Not one, two. Two elected Democratic Party officials endorsed a Republican in my actual House district. That's totally unacceptable. Am I going to sit around? No, I'm taking a break. I'm going to rest because I got 3 to 4 hours of sleep for 8 months, and I'm a tired human being. But when the time comes, I'm going to stand, and you and I will be first in line for that registry.
Well, come on up. I'll buy you some sweet tea in a seersucker suit. So no, I will not. Eric, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to come on. You are a friend. You even offered to drive up here to Charlottesville, the 7 hours to be on, but we figured out we could do it by phone.
Hey, let's go up to the Million Woman March together. I'll bring my daughter. You can bring your kid.
I'll see you there. This has been Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard. I sat in for Andre Hakes. Andre, I hope I did you proud, and I hope you'll be back next week. Eric, much love, my friend. Best of luck.
Duke it, Jeff.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.